This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents In This Sign by Joanne Greenberg. Foreword by Sarah Novick. Afterword by the author. Read for you by Lisa Flanagan. Introduction. When it comes to deaf culture, I can be protective. The American deaf community is a diverse and vibrant subculture with our own rich history, language, and shared values. We are also small, tight-knit, and extremely marginalized by the larger hearing society around us, which can make us proprietary about our stories. At the heart of deaf culture is American Sign Language, ASL, a language different from English not only in its modality but also in its vocabulary, grammar, syntax, and higher-level linguistic concepts. In part because of this language barrier, most hearing people can't or won't broach the divide between our worlds in a meaningful way in their lifetimes. As a result, deaf characters in fiction are a rarity, and when they do appear, they are often poorly rendered. Typically, deaf people in literature and film are pitiable, isolated, and innocent to the point of infantilization. These failures of the hearing imagination, the inability to comprehend that deaf people experience the full range of human emotions, have rich inner lives, and can be successful, are common on and off the page. Because of all this, we can be dismissive of hearing-made art about deaf culture. Theoretically, this isn't the best strategy, but then again, we've rarely been wrong. Across centuries of American literature, writers again and again confuse the physiological fact of deafness with the state of our intellect or our capacity for feeling. But being a non-speaking deaf person or one with heavily accented speech does not indicate that we are empty vessels in which to dump stereotypes or to use as symbols. We have much to say to those who will take the time to listen. Enter Joanne Greenberg. Born in Brooklyn, New York, in 1932, she is best known for her second novel, I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. Published in 1964, it is a semi-autobiographical account of a young woman's inpatient stay at a hospital while being treated for schizophrenia. Greenberg's portrayal of mental illness is decidedly unbeautiful, a departure from other cultural forces at the time, notably Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, published 1 year earlier. This was an explicit motivation, according to Greenberg, who said in an interview with the National Association for Rights Protection and Advocacy, NARPA, "I wrote I Never Promised You a Rose Garden as a way of describing mental illness without the romanticization that it underwent in the 60s and 70s. During those days, people often confused creativity with insanity. There is no creativity in madness. Madness is the opposite of creativity, although people may be creative in spite of being mentally ill." Greenberg is a writer who is clearly unafraid to approach complex topics from perspectives wholly her own, uninfluenced by trends of the zeitgeist. I can imagine that her lived experiences with mental illness have also made her familiar with the feeling of otherness in a society that so values normalcy. It makes sense, then, that Greenberg's interest was piqued by the deaf community, for whom her husband was working as a vocational rehabilitation counselor in the 1960s. In learning more about his clients and the systemic barriers they faced, Greenberg studied ASL and has since worked to establish deaf-accessible mental health programs at hospitals nationwide. Even knowing this, when I first cracked In the Sign, I was nervous about how an older book might portray deafness. Quickly, though, my worries were allayed. From its first pages, it's clear how effective Greenberg is at capturing the nuances of deaf culture. Originally published in 1970, the novel details the lives of deaf couple Abel and Janice Ryder, from their school days up through their eldest grandchild's college years, a timeline that spans from the 1920s to the 1960s. Abel's rural upbringing and attempted mainstream education result in language deprivation, an isolating syndrome that not only affects one's ability to communicate but also eventually causes cognitive damage. Most of Abel's childhood confusion and fear are crystallized in an upsetting sequence in which his mother shouts, "Ooh," at him repeatedly, then sends him into town alone, where he sits in a strange room all day. He does not realize until decades later, after learning ASL and having children of his own, that she must have been saying, "School." At the time of In the Signs publication, ASL had been recognized as a language for only about a decade. It was previously understood as gestures, or a bastardized version of English on the hands. As a result, American deaf education was only just beginning to wriggle out of the ironclad grip of the oralist ideology that had near unanimous rule since the late 19th century. Pure oralists believed that deaf people must be taught to speak and lip-read, and that sign language should be eradicated. Children caught waving hands were punished, their hands tied to desks, slammed in drawers, and struck with rulers. Eventually, Abel is freed from the confines of his isolation when he is sent to a school for the deaf as a teenager and begins to learn sign language. The school itself, though, is oral, as would have been typical of the 1920s, meaning the site of most deaf students' education was not inside the classroom at all. Every day for 2 hours, candles were blown out to make the letter P, and mouths moved to letters and pictures on the blackboard, and the students stared at tongues and teeth and lips. Dill, till, still, skill. But the words, the real words, were behind the outhouse, waiting, the language given and taken quickly at the fence. The forbidden signs made their users rich. Oralist programming prevented a lot of deaf children from reaching their academic potential. However, the gathering of deaf people together in campus spaces allowed the children themselves to pull one another up out of language deprivation to a degree. Abel began very slowly to wonder about words and thoughts themselves. Perhaps there were words for things not seen or touched. The more words Abel learned, the more things had meaning, the more memory. Simultaneously, Abel's new love for language bleeds into his admiration for a fellow student, Janice. Because Janice grew up boarding at the deaf school, she has always had sign, which is the thing that draws him to her. How busy she was and how wise, with plans and ideas, with friends, angers, and the small wars of enemies. To Abel, hand-mute in the mind silence of his farm and hearing school, these plans and arguments were so wide a life that they seemed magic. Meanwhile, Janice, who is more educated than Abel but has rarely left the confines of the school, is enamored of the possibility of outside that he represents. Janice loved the idea of traveling. She loved all motion, all change, and Abel, who had spent his life in the world, who must have traveled easily from farm to town to city, seemed to her and the others a prince of promise. Like many young people, Janice and Abel are in love with the idea of each other and of the gaps in their own lives the other might fill. They quickly bond and plan to build a life together. While Abel delights in his new ability to make sense of the world around him through language, ultimately the school has left both him and Janice ill-prepared to navigate a hearing world designed to hide and eventually eradicate them. The idea behind the pure oralist movement, emphasis on pure, wasn't so much effective pedagogy as xenophobia. Its rise at the turn of the 20th century coincided with the burgeoning popularity of nativist and eugenics groups, which were concerned with how to forcibly assimilate the large number of immigrants arriving on America's shores, as well as the language and culture of deaf people, who seemed to them just as alien as foreigners. Deaf and disabled people who found themselves in federal custody were often subject to compulsory sterilization. As for the broader civilian populations of immigrants and deaf people alike, another solution was posited. Just speak English. Around this time, Scottish immigrant Alexander Graham Bell used his budding fame as an inventor to become an influential spokesperson for both nativism and eugenics. In one 1913 letter to a friend, he wrote, "I believe that in an English-speaking country like the United States, the English language and the English language alone should be used as the means of communication and instruction." Having come from a family of speech teachers, Bell was quickly considered an authority on oral education. Perhaps his most infamous statements on the subject came from an 1883 address to the National Academy of Sciences, titled, "Memoir upon the Formation of a Deaf Variety of the Human Race." "Those who believe, as I do, that the production of a defective race of human beings would be a great calamity to the world will examine carefully the causes that will lead to the intermarriage of the deaf with the object of applying a remedy." Bell never outright advocated for the sterilization of deaf people. Instead, his remedy was a cultural one: the eradication of sign language. Without sign, deaf people wouldn't be able to congregate with ease and would thus be forced to assimilate. The thinking was that fewer deaf couples would mean fewer deaf babies, although the recessive nature of most genetic deafness meant this was mostly false. The very real result was a dark age for deaf children. Deaf teachers who could not teach speech were squeezed out of teaching roles, leaving deaf children language-deprived and uneducated. Greenberg's novel is nuanced in its portrayal of deaf people compared to the general understanding at the time, appearing as it did after nearly a century of pure oralism's rule. Impressively, Greenberg is also leagues ahead of her contemporaries. Deaf characters of note immediately before and after the publication of In This Sign are almost laughably one-dimensional in comparison to Abel and Janus. With even talented writers seeming either incurious about dismantling deaf-related clichés or bolstered by the rhetoric of saverism to speak over the deaf in problematic ways. Carson McCullough's John Singer in The Heart is a Lonely Hunter is saintly, a receptacle for hearing people's secrets and feelings, and once he is full to the brim, he is disposed of. Singer's deaf friend Spiros is also dead by novel's end. 8 years after In This Sign, Stephen King's The Stand, with its deaf-mute drifter Nick Andros, presents a cornucopia of problems, from the writer's questionable comprehension of the physiological components of deafness and speech, to Andros's sacrificial death for the lives of his hearing companions, to his reappearance in dreams, where he can always speak and hear. In whose dreams exactly? By contrast, Janus and Abel find agency in using the stereotypes others believe about them to get what they want. Of their finding ways to be together on campus, Greenberg writes, "Most of all, they used their deafness. They were all and completely mute. They understood nothing. They agreed to everything. They nodded and smiled and said yes to everyone. They promised to reform and then went where they wished." Later in the novel, Abel uses his landlord's assumptions of his diminished intellectual capacity to procure another week's stay in their apartment as they look for a new place to live. In their silence, the couple finds power. Greenberg, too, seems to make use of this. There is power in the novel's quietness. Part character study and part family saga, In This Sign is wholly steeped in the everyday, holding up a magnifier to Abel and Janice's relationships with each other, with their children and grandchildren, with their employers, with their fellow parishioners at the deaf church, and with their in-laws. That's not to say there isn't tension in the novel. Over the course of it, I was often as gripped by these somewhat commonplace interactions, the friction between Janice and her co-workers due to her superior performance on the factory floor, or Janice and Abel's first meeting with their son-in-law-to-be, as I am while reading a thriller. I spent a while trying to reverse engineer this craft trick. How did Greenberg make the minutiae of our daily lives feel so monumental? Eventually, I realized that through astute and wholly authentic observations, she had simply cultivated an intense empathy for Abel and Janice. Which is to say, it wasn't a trick at all. The quietness of In This Sign is, I think, one of the novel's greatest successes, because it forces readers to reckon with the intricacies of deaf people as people, not only in big trajectory-changing events, but mostly in the little moments. The hardships that Abel and Janice do experience aren't because they're deaf, but because they're human and must contend with the full range of what it means to grow up and raise a family against the backdrop of a rapidly changing society. At times, these hardships are certainly made more difficult by the inaccessibility of the hearing world. A misunderstanding between Abel and a car salesman at the opening of the novel results in wage garnishing that further burdens the family financially in an economically tumultuous time. The pain of losing a child is made harsher and more humiliating in the struggle to communicate while coffin shopping. Because of this, some readers have criticized the portrayal of Abel as ignorant and Janice as quick to anger for casting deaf people in a negative light. And while it's true, especially at the time of its first publication when there were few portrayals of deaf characters, that some might mistake these characters' struggles and failures as inherent to deafness itself, I don't think that's the book that Greenberg wrote. Deafness isn't a monolith. It would be unfair to ask any writer or character to fully embody a deaf perspective. And what's more, Greenberg's care in foregrounding Abel's language deprivation and the failures of oral education makes it clear that his and Janice's confusion over and mistrust of the hearing world are not character flaws, but the result of a deeply flawed system designed to crush them. Today's readers encountering Abel and Janice amid a more robust backdrop of deaf literature, including works by deaf writers, will be even better positioned to appreciate the complexity, the humanity, and the ugliness in This Sign's pages. Through the eyes of their hearing daughter, Margaret, we also see moments when Abel and Janice's limitations are self-imposed. Abel buys himself a hearing aid, which he wears and dislikes, as a gift for Margaret, thinking she'd find him more presentable, when the electronic gift that Margaret is really pining for is a radio. Janice feels self-conscious in both the hearing and deaf worlds, worried about being seen signing at the factory and afraid for the family to attend the deaf church without the right clothing. These failures are important because they're specific to the character's own personalities and ideologies rather than indicative of deafness. In a literary world of so many Tiny Tims, I appreciate that Abel and Janice are sometimes unlikable. Greenberg respects her characters enough to craft fully realized human beings, warts and all. It's undeniable that Janice's and Abel's lives are not exactly beautiful, marked often by strain and struggle. But if all the hardships and slights they endure at the hands of hearing people are upsetting, I'd implore readers to see these injustices as a call to action, to advocate tirelessly for an education system that, instead of providing deaf children with the veneer of inclusive education, gives them the robust linguistic and academic skills they'll need for a safe and successful future. A call to action to stand in solidarity with the deaf community, whose self-determination remains under attack. Today, pure oralism, now rebranded as Listening Spoken Language Approach, LSL, still exists as a powerful force in deaf education, perpetuating isolation and cognitive damage through language deprivation that doesn't look much different from what Abel might have experienced nearly 100 years earlier. In this way, it's unfortunate that Greenberg's novel has stood the test of time. Ultimately, though, if Greenberg has pulled back the curtain on the suffering of disabled people in an oppressive society, she has also given us the answer for how to overcome it. In the final pages of the novel, we see Abel, Janice, and their grown daughter chatting. Together, they laugh. And it's clear that this novel isn't only one of deaf hardship, but also one of bravery and great joy. Margaret's son, Marshall, has left home to join the civil rights movement, and the three discuss what he might be hoping to achieve. He wants us to end poverty and despair, Margaret says. Abel, whose once halting sign is now described as elegant, says proudly, "We did that." When Margaret explains that Marshall is thinking of change on a larger scale, Abel and Janice suggest the solution must be something like sign, sweeping and propulsive, passed down and across generations with both care and urgency. The thing that changed their lives and made its users rich. Sarah Novick. To Albert. The right hand, palm inward, covers the left hand, which rests on the heart. 1. They sat on the bench and waited. Now and then, people walked past them on the mysterious errands of the law, and as they passed, looked at them sitting there and then looked again with small, quickly hidden smiles. They had been sitting on the bench for almost an hour, and slowly Abel had begun to understand why the looks were strange. They were sitting very straight, he and Janice, because they were frightened. It made them stiffen their clothes. The strange looks were because their clothes were not correct for the season. He had felt so free and wise in these same clothes before. They had been beautiful when they were new. He remembered walking proudly out of the store in them into the carefully portioned light of September, knowing that the last of his great money had gone for them. It was January now, and Janice beside him was still summer, all summer green and gold and wearing a hat full of flowers. Maybe it wasn't the right thing for her to wear the thin gauze dress or a hat piled with flowers, but it was her good outfit. It made him remember the summer days and her running down the street toward him, running for joy, the wonderful automobile and the food, all the food, and the tent show they went to in August, and how in the summer what they had and what they hoped for made a shine in their eyes and faces and gave to each of their ways and gestures a special grace. All of his summers before were nothing but a haze of dust and the smell of dust, tiredness and sweat. That was the farm. Town summer was different. He thought he had never looked at a tree when the leaves were full, or walked in the night's little wind, or seen the green moving sun dapple on someone's face, or felt it on his own. Janice's yellow hair was warm and it smelled of herself and of the sun. He gave her a green jewel ring to keep the sunlight in, and he got himself a marvelous watch, fat with numbers, a chain and a fob charm in the shape of a lion's head with red jewel eyes. The summer. Janice moved a little. The door of the courtroom had swung open, and she was leaning forward to catch a look at the inside. They saw some benches, rows of them, but the door swung closed again. And that was all. A man in a heavy coat came around the corner and toward them. Abel began to raise his hand just a little for Janice to tell her that this was his boss, Mr. Webendorf. There was another man with him, a thin man, very clean and dressed tightly, a stranger. But before Abel could get up and give his greetings, Mr. Webendorf nodded and went away into the courtroom, and the stranger was left standing in front of them.
"Comstock," he spelled out with his fingers and into their astonishment. "I'm here to interpret for you."
"You deaf?" Abel asked, stuttering because his hands followed his mind.
"Parents," Comstock said. "I work for the court sometimes. Come on, they're ready for us now."
His sign was quick, educated, a little ugly with impatience. Abel and Janice turned to each other, surprised.
"Let's go, let's go," Comstock said.
He swung through the door and they winced and followed. A man took them all the way to the front of the courtroom near the judge, and between the judge and themselves, Mr. Comstock stood. Everyone swore to tell the truth, and then the thing began. It was, the judge said, a hearing. Weren't all of them hearing? Latitude, what was latitude? Would be given the respondent in his replies in consideration of his infirmity. The beautiful, unmeaning words that the judge was saying broke hard through Comstock's fingers. Into the dark wood and stone room, an old, shaking sunlight was slowly venturing. Chair by chair, it crept the way down the aisle, and by the time Mr. Dengel, the automobile dealer, was finished with what he said, The light had slid down and gone to sleep between the front row of chairs and the tables where people talked to the judge. Abel was happy to watch the light. It was the only thing in the room which was not strange to him. Mr. Dengel was the man who had sold him the car. This trouble must be about the car, then. Mr. Dengel talked for a long time, saying everything about the car, about the color and the kind and the different papers that had to be signed because of it. But when he told about the money, what the car cost, Abel had to jump up and tell what was true, because the car did not cost what Mr. Dengel said. That was a lie. Then the judge was angry, and Comstock's hands shot out that anger against Abel and told him that if he did not sit down and wait until he was called, he would be fined for contempt of court. What was fined? What was contempt? Abel saw then that it was very important to keep them all from anger. He sat down. Mr. Dengel said some more, and the judge asked things, and then told Abel that he too must tell about the car. He began, trying to see everything clearly in his mind. Town and the shining machine and the summer. They came in late spring, he and Janice, from his father's farm. There was a job for him and for Janice. They had a room on Perrer Street and money for their start. The savings his father gave him in a deep, old-fashioned snap purse. On his way home from the printing shop each night, he walked past the place where they sold the automobiles. He always stood for a while, staring. On nice nights, the big doors were open and a light was on so people could stop and see the beautiful machines, glowing and smooth. Sometimes the man came out and took someone by the arm and smiled to him to come and sit behind the wheel and notice this thing or that, try the horn, try the lights. Once Abel was that person. The man motioned to him and he went and sat in the car while the man spoke to him aside, privately, like someone of special fame. He didn't need to hear the words to feel the honor, so he smiled and nodded to show how glad he was because of it. Then the man began to write numbers on a paper. He showed them, and Abel nodded under the light. All that time the man was saying and saying things, his mouth moving without rest. Smiling, too, because he was telling Abel that for the small savings in the snap purse, for only the small money which his father gave him, it was true. It was to be his own, his and Janice's. That wonderful car. Then Abel nodded yes and yes again and signed the papers, and the man came all the way around the car and opened the door and shook his hand. Abel also remembered very clearly the light trembling in the leaves of those summer evenings. The air was warm and the late light was warm, and more rich golden light lay all along the streets. In such a light, he came to the room and told Janice about the automobile. She was so excited they left without eating dinner and went back to see it. The streets and stores were dark by then. There was little to see, but they were glad they had gone anyway. They walked home slowly, in silence, because of the dark. The stars here were not spread out on one wide night as it was back on the farm. They were comfortably measured and held between the buildings of the city. Everything they saw, thought, and knew had splendor for them, happiness, richness, and strength. They looked at everything in a clearer light. How could there be bad in such joy, in any of it? Tell about the car. The car was blue, very, very smooth to touch. It made the days perfect. Abel tried to describe the silvered fittings gleaming on it and the steadily made fine outlines, red painted around the wheels. A new car, Pierce Arrow 1919. The judge was restless in his chair. Comstock told Abel to hurry, so he tried to ask how it was anyone's fault if the joy of the car was short. He was used to handling horses, and the need to see far ahead and rule every move of the machine was strange to him. On his first drive, he ran the car into a fence. On the second, he scared some horses and they kicked at the back of it, and in fear, he steered too much, so that the machine tipped over on its side. Also, he did wrong many times to use up all the gas, and Janice became too frightened to go in it. She began to nag at him to sell it. For a moment, he stopped speaking, his hands caught over a sign. He was remembering the anger he had felt at Janice then. For a week he did not speak to her, not even giving a greeting night or morning. She was afraid to ride with him. She kept asking him to sell the auto. She cried and told him she was afraid. After many fights and crying and days without speaking, and after two more accidents, he agreed to sell the machine. He put a sign on the car and sold it to a man who was passing. They wrote out different prices until they agreed. At first, Abel was proud because he sold the car for more money than he paid. Then, for a week after, he was sad the way people feel when someone dies. He and Janice walked on Sunday.
"Hurry," Comstock said. "The judge does not want to know your feelings."
"I will tell everything. How can he know if I do not tell everything?" When they walked, he went on, they began to look at the prices of all the beautiful things in the stores and the food in restaurants, and they began to see that the car money could give them all these things. That was how they had the idea to have and buy the jewels and clothes. Abel smiled. The pride they had in this richness made them sleep well every night and wake up hungry and be glad and work all day with quickness. At night, they went to restaurants and ate every kind of strange and remarkable food that never was on the farm or in the cold school where they met. On Sunday afternoon, the stores were open, and Janice began to look carefully at how town women dressed. He bought her the hat, the one she was wearing. He bought her the ring with the wonderful jewel in it, and his watch and the chain and fob charm, this lion's head with a jewel eye. When the tent show and fair came in August, they went. They bought a toy monkey on a string, spinning tops, pinwheels, pine needle pillows and cedar pillows and Chinese burning sticks to smell good, and many different kinds of paper flowers. The summer. He smiled again.
"And what then?" the judge asked.
Summer ended then. One evening after work, Abel and Janice counted all their money. The warm days were gone and the money joyfulness shriveled. The nights were getting cool for summer clothes. They tried to be cheerful, but soon it was cold at night, and the mill girls walked from work in hard dark, shivering. Then they saw that they could not eat away from the room until payday. All the starting money was gone. All the car money was gone. Still, they weren't angry. Abel didn't tell the judge about the store windows. The judge would laugh if he knew that they always used those windows for mirrors, and that in those windows it was still summer. When Abel passed them, he saw a well-dressed man walking, a man raised in a city, not a boy from a stone farm. A man of ways, of things, not a boy of fear. And beside him, smiling and sure, a gold-glowing woman, his wife. They walked together past the windows, and people nodded to them and smiled sometimes, not knowing what they really were. Taking them for city people, surely. Successful, rich, unafflicted. The winter came, Abel said, and all the money was gone. They had to use all the money they made. That was Abel's $6 a week and Janice's 14. She worked in a mill sewing caps and jackets, and the hours were 7 to 7. When she came home, she was angry because of no more dinners out, and after the rent and food, there was nothing left for extra coal for hot water. They were afraid to buy a gas ring, and she couldn't cook, so they had to eat in the room cold dinners and be afraid of the landlady. The judge was speaking. Comstock said there were questions.
"When you bought the car, did you read what was given to you to sign?"
"It was about the car. I signed it because it was about the car."
"Why didn't you answer the letters that were sent to you?"
"They were about the car too, but I sold the car. The car was gone then. How can it help to read about it?"
"Weren't you aware that you had made only partial payment?"
"What?"
"Didn't you know you made only part of the payment, that you had more to pay?"
"No."
Abel's eyes went from the judge to Comstock and back again, watching how his own words were taken up, judged, and laid aside in the law. Now the judge was not speaking, but Comstock's hands were breaking words.
"I bet you tried to hide that you were deaf. I'll bet you never told him you were deaf."
Abel looked again at the judge, but his mouth was not moving.
Abel was afraid. This Comstock knew what no hearing knew and how to ask it. This Comstock was trying to hurt him with secrets, things that could only be known by a child of their own people.
"Did you tell him you are deaf?"
The judge wasn't asking that. I didn't see his mouth move.
"Did you?"
"No." Abel's no was almost invisible, quick, hesitating. A barely formed triangle of the hand, and then, "I did not tell him. He called me sir."
Comstock's mouth was moving for the judge.
Abel watched, and because he knew what would be said, he was able to read a little from the side.
"Man, say, he was deaf. People, ashamed." "But why?"
Abel could read the words on the judge's lips because they were few. He looked away. The sun had awakened from the floor and had gone touching weakly up on the legs of some of the chairs. A little bit reached Janice and climbed on her dress as she sat watching in the third row. She looked like a stranger. The sun went away, tired. Comstock was finished. The judge looked out at Janice for a moment, and Abel saw that she wanted to smile but was too frightened. Then the judge began to speak again, and Comstock asked,
"Did you try to read Mr. Dengel's lips?"
"Yes, I cannot read him. He chews a cigar while he talks."
"But three letters were sent. Didn't you think the letters might be important?"
"I tried to read them, but I didn't understand. Only that they were about the car. I sold the car."
The judge shook his head and said something, and Comstock flipped the words out to Abel in disgust. "Go and sit down."
Abel began to sit, then stopped and said, "Why are you angry?"
Comstock's eyes got wider.
"You? Why are you angry? You don't know us. The judge is not angry."
Comstock's hands flew with his words. "You damned fool! You'll be out begging in the street before winter is over with a sign on your shirt."
His sign was almost too quick to understand.
"Hearing will pity you because they're stupid and they pity all deaf, so you'll beg and all the deaf will be pitied. Why did you come here and make trouble? People who work hard and never owed a cent will be called deafy and be laughed at and taken advantage because of you. You're nothing but a damn beggar."
The judge moved his mouth, and Comstock turned with a smooth gesture to say he was only explaining something. Then Mr. Webendorf was called. Mr. Webendorf told about Abel. It was strange to hear Comstock's hands saying things about Abel's own life. Yes, he was hired from apprentice training at the deaf and dumb school. Yes, he worked well in the big shop and was a good and responsible second-year apprentice. It was true that most apprentices were only boys, but since the man was deaf... Then the judge asked about wages, and Mr. Webendorf told about that.
"He gets union scale for second year. $6 a week to start, and last month it was raised to $7.
The judge looked surprised, and Mr. Webendorf went on.
"In 3 years, he'll be making $14, and when he's finished his 6 years, he'll get good money, $28.
Then he stopped and shook his head and said, "I didn't know about the car." Abel felt the same kind of shame as once before, when his father had beaten him. But he couldn't look away from the words.
"I didn't know anything about the clothes or, well, the wife either. The boy came in the same every day in old clothes. I knew where he stayed. It was a room. I didn't know he had a wife with him. If he'd come to me, I would have told him how bad it was. All his savings."
The judge moved in his dignity and began to speak. In a strange way, Comstock's hands made his words of a different speaking than Webendorf's. The judge's words came heavy, loud and full. They swung in strong curves. They waited longer on the air. They were so beautiful that Abel leaned back in awe watching them. They were so rich that he didn't understand any of them.
"As deeply aware as the court had been made of the plight of the respondent," the judge words said, "the law was clear. The car had been sold, and the respondent, having concealed his infirmity from the complainant, was guilty of what amounted to fraud."
So beautiful, those words. Abel watched them as they moved in their long rhythms. They reminded him of other long rhythm things, pitching hay, scything.
Yet this infirmity was also a mitigating circumstance, and although the garnishment of the maximum of 10% of the respondent's wages was mandatory, the court was inclined to favor a more lenient approach to the fraud charge than would ordinarily be entertained.
Comstock finished. Abel sat staring at him patiently, waiting for meaning.
"I am going to order payment," the judge continued, "over the 10% garnishment, which will cover the fine of $100 and the additional court costs. The payment will be $2 a week for the next 5 months, increasing to $3 as the apprenticeship wages are raised, and so on by wage steps until the apprenticeship is finished, and thereafter $5 a week until the debt is satisfied. The court hopes that the interest rate will be no more than 6%.
The judge looked at the dealer.
"Although there is no law against usurious practice, the court hopes that in this case you will modify your present custom."
Abel's hands moved restlessly for the interpreter. "I do not understand the words. What did he say? Did I win or lose?"
Comstock made a gesture of disgust and turned to the judge again.
Abel saw the judge smile a little.
"Lost the case," the judge says. "Lost it," Comstock's hands said in a pretty way.
Then,
"The court has no choice. The law is clear. The judge wants me to tell you that it could have been much, much worse."
Comstock had to begin again to explain to Abel what payments would have to be made and where he was to bring the money each month. It no longer seemed a matter if he understood the words or the complicated secret balance of the law. He sat like a suffering animal, too sick to get up, too enduring to fall down. Then Comstock was finished. He said,
"I told you, you will be a beggar. No deaf will speak to you. You—"
stopped. The winter light of the courtroom had stopped him, coming up in front of him in a bright, dusty band that made him squint to see Abel on the far side of it. The judge had gotten up and the people were leaving. It was over.
"I will never beg," Abel said, but he saw clearly in his mind a picture of himself sitting at a wall with his hat out, because he was too weak to stand. "You will ruin everything for all the deaf around here," Comstock said, without knowing if Abel could see his hands. "I wish you'd stayed out on the farm, hidden away somewhere."
He began to walk to the doors. There was a sound on the other side of the sun shaft. Abel had put his head down on the table and with both fists, one on either side, was slowly pounding.
2. They had to sell the ring that kept green sunlight. Abel had paid $70 for it, and after Webendorf wrote about what interest was, he knew there was no choosing now between this hope and that. Janice cried and argued. She made him spend nights adding and adding again numbers that never changed. And in the end, he made her take the sunlight ring off her finger, and they went back to the jeweler's with it. Abel remembered the jeweler who was pleased with them, a happy and friendly man when they had come before. Now he looked at the ring with quick eyes and didn't hold it up to catch the light the same as before. He did not smile now, but was careful and kept his arms close to his body.
$20, he said.
A fear came like something falling down inside of Abel. They tried to show the jeweler his mistake. They were careful, trying to make the man remember who they were, that they had bought his ring for $70. Janice spoke more clearly of the two. They knew this because people seemed less impatient with her than they were with Abel. Their faces did not always harden with dislike when she used her voice. And so she spoke, asking the jeweler if he remembered this ring, the same ring he sold them in the summer. She motioned to the box behind the shining glass.
"Iwa ear, ear."
She pointed again. Abel remembered how carefully the ring was put in the fold that held it, in the box. How carefully the jeweler reached in and took it and lifted it to feed it with light, and then held it out to them. Maybe he did not understand. He motioned to Janice with his eyes to write, "We are people we came in summer and buy this ring, $70. Jewel is very good care. Always take off before wash.
The jeweler read the note quickly and shook his head. Then he wrote, $20, and put a line under it. They didn't give up the ring, and they didn't go, but stood stunned and pale in front of him. He took the paper again and wrote, I am in business. I will give you $25 and no more. The ring is used, not new anymore. If you can't get a better price for it somewhere else, come back and I will still give you $25.
Janice would never sign in front of hearing, but now she turned Abel away and began in the smallest of sign to say what she had to. I'm afraid. What is happening to them? Why are they doing this to us? What will we do?
I don't know. We can't go to the police.
You are the husband. You must make him take the ring and give us our money.
He won't do it.
You must make him do it.
Go on, he said, and wait outside. I will talk to him. Alone.
She looked away and made a small, quick sign of goodbye, leaving the store. Abel saw she felt better to go. He picked up the ring from the glass where it was lying and with his left hand motioned the jeweler to come with him toward the back of the store, darker, where Janice could not see them. Abel began to walk back. His loneliness pulled into a single place that reminded him of a time he could not name. The jeweler did not look at him. Then Abel took from his pocket the marvelous watch and the fob with the golden lion's head and red jewel eye that gleamed even in the dim place.
Take it, he said.
He could see the man's eyes narrowing with bad thoughts at the sound of his voice. The man turned to him and Abel said,
A ring and wa and everything,
and then wrote, $70. Even then the jeweler didn't look at him. He only turned and struck his money machine and the drawer ran open. He counted out money fast and put it on the counter, and as Abel picked it up, the jeweler swept the wonderful things into his hand like crumbs from a table. How carefully they had come from the cases before. Each thing was held like something alive and important. Now their poorness, his and Janice's, spoiled the jewels. The green stone was unlucky. The watch had given bad hours to count. The jeweler took them to hide them away in shame. An assistant came from the back of the store and was standing too near for comfort. Abel walked with his head up, hoping he wouldn't bump into the door in his pain. He felt the shadows of the two men behind him. He wondered if they were laughing in the hearing world behind him.
Did you get the money?
Yes.
All of it?
Yes. They stood by a restaurant window and pretended to look in.
When the owing is finished, we will buy it back.
Never. I will never go there again.
I want to hope for it.
Never again. He made me ashamed.
There was someone on the other side of the window watching them, so they turned and went on. As they came to the corner and started across the street, Abel took his hands out of his pockets and said fast into the cold,
This is outside, outside. This is where everyone wants to go. Everyone runs.
Then he put back his hands and glared. Silence. Outside was all everyone talked about at school. Their eyes shone when they spoke of it, and down the narrow halls railed for the blind, they made their signs sail over the teachers' heads, hide behind books, slip between the desks, and the signs talked about outside. For Abel, there was never sign before on the farm, and no real words. He came to the school mute and deaf to everyone, even to all the others who were as deaf as he. He took the boys' program, lip-reading, arithmetic, reading, and writing, and had a choice of three trades, kitchen helper, printer's helper, boilermaker's helper. The girls' programs taught lip-reading and sewing. These things the school taught. The things the boys and girls learned from one another were the language of signs and the dream of outside. Every day for 2 hours, candles were blown out to make the letter P, and mouths moved to letters and pictures on the blackboard, and the students stared at tongues and teeth and lips. Dill, till, still, skill. But the words, the real words, were behind the outhouse waiting. The language given and taken quickly at the fence. The forbidden signs made their users rich.
After 6 months at the school, Abel had friends and enemies, and outside. Now he was outside, and he had the words to lie awake in bed and think of the time in school. It was a bad-smelling place, without color or taste. A dark place. Color and light are wasted on the blind. The school served blind as well as deaf, and so denied both. It seemed strange to him that in the school's ugliness he had found Janice. Janice had gold hair, a smile that made him burn and be cold at the same time, a quickness, a slowness like water going over stones when the sun shines on it. He was pulled by her and changed by her the way the river changed him when he went under the water. It made him another creature in another world. He was shy about being overage in the school. He came for the trades training, and after years of trying to understand lip reading and to talk, he had been amazed to find there were in the world others of his kind. He was 18 then. Janice was 16. She had grown up in the school and knew almost nothing about outside. She did know sign, the forbidden language. How confidently she joked and gossiped and talked behind the backs of the instructors. How busy she was and how wise, with plans and ideas, with friends, angers, and the small wars of enemies. To Abel, hand mute in the mind silence of his farm and hearing school, these plans and arguments were so wide a life that they seemed magic, beyond belief. In 3 months, he learned all the signs that anyone knew. His fingerspelling was faith alone, but he dared it. Listening, talking, telling, sharing, arguing, wondering. He was made free in a language learned in spite of watchful teachers. Until he began to go with Janice, this language took a part of the places where it was learned. It seemed to smell of standing water, bathrooms, shame, hiddenness, and lie cleaner. Hands that masturbated in the storehouse doorway spoke about it before and after, and the boys signed in their cold sweat sleep. When the older ones had the twice-yearly lecture on the dangers of self-abuse, Abel, sitting among them, wondered if the teacher who spoke of touching and rubbing, of fear and release, was referring to speech. The boys and the girls were seldom together, so he saw Janice many times before they met. After they spoke once or twice, he began to look for her, and he found that she had her chore in the kitchen washing the pots. His wanting to be with her made him learn more than ever. He had to watch the teachers and see what made them forget him so that he could get away. He had to learn the times when there were people busy around the kitchen so Janice could take the chance to be away from her work. There were not many times to slip away from training or meet her as she went to her own class. The need to see her made him watchful and keen and took away some of his innocence. He began to see how Mr. Conroy's habit of a smoke in the afternoon could be used, how his own regular habits, even faults like lateness, began to have a kind of order about them until they were accepted as his way. He met Janice outdoors behind the kitchen, or when it was too cold, in the empty hall outside the dining room. He got cautious, so he stopped going with other boys to hide in the attic over the blind girl's dormitory. He stopped fighting with everyone who said things about his age, and he began very slowly to wonder about words and thoughts themselves. Perhaps there were words for things not seen or touched, and for thoughts not as simple as go or stay. It was Janice who first asked him what he thought about the people and things they knew, and then about his wishes and his dreams. The idea came to him that there was a big open place inside him that felt and saw pictures of great meaning for which there were no words, and that someday he might be able to tell her some of the difference he felt between the world he saw and the world that saw him. Of all the girls, Janice was the one most interested in outside. When anyone spoke about it, she came alive. The more words Abel learned, the more things had meaning. The more meaning, the more memory. She began to ask him questions. What was his town like? Were there many cars? What kind of clothes did the rich people wear? What did their houses look like? Was it nice on the farm? Was the work hard? She asked more questions about town than about the farm, and even more about the city. City was outside at its richest. City was everything that was new and joyful and always changing. Janice loved the idea of traveling. She loved all motion, all change, and Abel, who had spent his life in the world, who must have traveled easily from farm to town to city, seemed to her and the others a prince of promise. His smallest memory had the weight of great wisdom. During his second year, he and Janice were together everywhere, and together they ruined all the attempts the school made to put them out of each other's way. They found forgotten windows and unused storage rooms. Most of all, they used their deafness. They were all and completely mute. They understood nothing. They agreed to everything. They nodded and smiled and said yes to everyone, teacher, matron, and master. They promised to reform and then went where they wished. In April, they ran away together. Outside. They found a church like one Abel knew at home. When the minister saw what they wanted and that they were deaf, he wrote another man's name on a paper for them, and so they were directed finally to a justice of the peace, who married them without questions, for 4 times the usual fee. That Monday morning, they presented themselves back at the school to start their week's work as though nothing had happened. The school was afraid of bad talk, so it pretended not to notice them and allowed Janice to graduate with her class. They told her to write to her parents immediately. She put off doing it, and in the end, the superintendent wrote to both families and told them of the marriage. When school was over, Janice and Abel went to his parents' farm. Janice's parents had 13 other children. They sent best wishes in a letter to Janice, and no return address. Abel and Janice took the train. Outside, she opened her eyes wide to try to see all of it, touch all of it, taste, smell, feel all of outside. She gleamed with life. Now Abel turned in the bed and watched her sleeping. Sometimes brushing across his mind too quickly to make words was a feeling. It was the beginning of an idea, and it was about the courts and stores and people, that maybe they were not hating or angry at his deafness and Janice's, but that they did not care. Strangely, the not caring was worse than hate. Always in school there was talk about hate, the laughter and cruelty of hearing people. Some had things they told over and over again, their faces all stiff with anger, and they told these things to everyone many times, until everyone knew they had pleasure telling and a big pride in the pain and laughter that was put against them. Abel began to feel that outside's real cruelness had to do not with hating, but with not caring. He did not have the words to tell this to Janice, and so the thought stayed haunting the rims of his mind, almost making itself plain. He was also sometimes close to another knowledge, that the world was working against them, and that their ignorance of the world was against them more, much more. This, too, was only a sudden running of something across a place that was lit too late to see by. There were no words to hold it. His trouble weighed all night in the close room. Every night for a week he tried to find a way to stop that money, $6,000, and more because of what they called interest. Interest meant liking something. It meant working well and staying awake. He knew the sign for it. It was close, that sign, to the one for liking. Now, by some strange hearing law, this good thing was made into money, more money for Mr. Dengel. It was Mr. Dengel who was staying awake and interested enough. Janice and Abel could only live on Janice's $14 a week, and his own money this second half of second year of apprenticeship, $7 less 70 cents to pay the debt. If they were careful, they could creep past the court and the jail. If they were very careful and there was no more trouble. But there was no money left for hope. Each half year there would be more money going to fill the debt. It was all to keep strangers calm, all to keep them from anger. The hearing are always angry. One thing they had always told him in school: keep working. They had begun his trade, they said, because they wanted him kept safe, and working, they said, was safety. Beside him, Janice signed in a dream, vague, unreadable signs, and she turned in her sleep. Just before the summer ended, at the top of all the good things, they had met a deaf man who had told them about a church for deaf on the other side of the city. Once a week, a minister came and had services in sign.
At school, it was often said that one part of the hearing world had time for them. Churches. They had made a plan to go as soon as they could with jobs and nice clothes, the ring, the watch. They wanted to make friends, to have habits, to invite and be invited. Now the world was cold. Ring and watch and money and hope were gone. Even if they could pay the car fare to that church, they wouldn't go. The friends were too expensive now and the hope too feared for. Abel stirred the bed again, trying to find the right position for sleep, and it came at last, heavy with scattering gray dreams. 3. Several times during that winter, Janice and Abel wondered, each secretly to himself, if he was going to die. There was starving, freezing, or even broken heart, which Janice had heard of at school. So they waited, watching for something out of the sides of their eyes. But they did not die. They only imitated the living, and the months went on. Days counted like papers that Abel shuffled and made one jog in his printer hands and then put away. After the court, Abel felt a change in Mr. Webbendorf. He was more impatient. He did not smile or wave in a friendly way. For some weeks, Abel was sad and angry, but soon he got used to it and its hurt was flat. The time passed over it and made the new way into a habit. Webbendorf was hearing, Abel told Janice, and hearing always change. She nodded, but she wasn't listening to him. She was thinking instead about the mill. There were two other deaf girls working in the cap room, and she hadn't told him. Half a room away, she had seen them signing quick and secret over their lunches, and slowly, so no one would look. She had begun to make a way closer to them. It was better to be careful, not to get attention, and three deaf girls together might bring trouble. So she waited, and when the time came, she made sign, the bare word, fast as thought, a word without breath, without sound, without motion except the flicker seen and known only by people whose lives are turned to motion. They gave her understanding with an eye blink, and at lunchtime, without seeming to move, made place along the back wall. They were always together after that, turning no attention to themselves but sitting by the damp north wall that no one else would choose for an eating place. They sat close, hands hidden by one another's backs, and they talked, leaving only the last minute or two for the crazy eat without chewing before the work bell broke them apart. They hated the bell. It came to Janice as a numbing thrum up through the bones of her feet and buttocks and up her spine, counting all the hidden ends and edges, the way a blind man must feel things, into the bones of her face, again and again until her teeth rang and she chewed upon the bell. For hearing, it must be that way always, chewing bells, chewing voices. She wondered how hearing could stand it. Sound. At the bell, there was time only for a last swallow, gathering up the greasy papers, brushing crumbs from the lip, the hand flick goodbye, and back to the lighter, smaller chewing of the sound of the room full of sewing machines. Janice had been working in the cap room for 8 months. Her work was fast. She didn't look at her hand.